can hang out. Apparently everybody can. Well, I got no problem with it. What are we doing? All right. All right. Gospel reading time. Please assume the position in honor of the reading of the gospel, standing, sitting, staring intently into space, whatever works for you. And hear these words from Mark 10, 35 through 45, please. James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came forward to Jesus and said to him, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." And he said to them, "What is it you want me to do for you?" They said to him, "Appoint us to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left, in your glory." But Jesus said to them, "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with?" They replied, "We are able." Then Jesus said to them, "The cup that I drink, you will drink, and with the baptism with which I am baptized, you will be baptized. But to sit at my right hand or at my left is not mine to appoint, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared." When the 10 heard this, they began to be angry with James and John. So Jesus called them and said to them, "You know that among the Gentiles, those whom they recognize as their rulers lord it over them, and their great ones are tyrants over them. But it is not so among you. Instead, whoever wishes to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you must be servant of all. For the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You can be seated now, and while we're doing that, we'll dismiss the young ones to junior worship, and we'll sing them out. Jesus loves me this time.
Everyone. Thanks, Shannon and worship team, leading us in song, and Carolyn, that prayer. Man, thank you, and Karen, for welcoming us into service this morning. October, as you know, as you've heard this morning, is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Ron and Lori focused on this at our 9:30 hour, and I'm going to try and share a few words about it as well during our sermon. The point of all of this talk being for us to break the silence that often surrounds domestic violence simply by speaking about it, by us being purposeful and naming it, challenging it, considering what we might do in response to it, we begin the process of combating it. So that's the hope today. Just one more step, even if it's a small step, one more step forward in the journey towards healing and safety and shalom. But before I say any more about that, allow me to say this as well. For the victims of domestic violence, which I'll refer to throughout as DV, domestic violence, for the victims, even speaking about domestic violence can be a source of trauma. And so I want to acknowledge that even before we begin with these few reflections and say, if this is the case for you, our shepherds, several of our professional counselors, and of course the Clarks are here, ready and eager to support you as needed. One last introductory note here. If you are interested in learning more than what we talk about today regarding a theological response to domestic violence, I'd like to recommend to you two books by our own Ron Clark. Setting the Captives Free, A Christian Theology for Domestic Violence, and its follow-up, Freeing the Oppressed, A Call to Christians Concerning Domestic Abuse. Both of these books are excellent and provide helpful insights and further resources. So, if you're interested, here are a couple options for you. Now, speaking of the Clarks, if you weren't here at the 9:30 hour to hear Ron and Lori, allow me to review just a few statistics and a definition. What even is DV? Broadly speaking, what we're talking about here, again, just very broadly speaking, domestic violence, or as it's sometimes called, intimate partner violence, is the use of power through selfishly motivated patterns of behavior intended to exercise and maintain control over one's partner. Power for the sake of control. There are, of course, other forms of violence that overlap with this definition, but DV is primarily focused upon power and control between intimate partners in a shared home. So, we got some of that this morning already. Of course, our society does not tend to talk about domestic violence all that much, which, needless to say, is, of course, part of the problem. So, allow me to offer you just briefly a few data points to highlight the devastating reality of domestic violence. Perhaps all of these will be familiar to you. If not, I think it's good that we hear them. And perhaps none is more important than this. Across the world today, I wonder if you've ever heard this. Across the world today, women ages 15 to 44, for women ages 15 through 44, the number one, single highest, leading cause of injury, disability, and death is not cancer. It is not malaria, as devastating as it is. It's not traffic accidents. It's not even war. But rather, domestic violence. Just consider that for a moment. And in comparison to these other tragedies I've just named, we hardly ever mention it. And it is the leading cause of death, injury, and disability for women in our world today. An incredible 41% of women and 26% of men experience domestic violence in their lifetime. Meaning, statistically, 2 out of every 5 women in this room, 1 out of every 4 men, experience intimate partner violence. Or, to come at it from another angle, and speaking of just women here, every 9 seconds, a woman is assaulted or beaten. Every 9 seconds. And if we include the terror of being stalked by an abuser, 24 people per minute are victims of an intimate partner in the United States, translating to more than 12 million men and women over the course of a single year. And of course, as we all know, they are not the only victims. 15.5 million children witness domestic violence annually. And if that enormous number is too difficult to get your mind around, 15.5 million, let me put it this way. 1 out of every 15 children are exposed to intimate partner violence every year. That means at least 2 children in every class you've ever been in witness DV in their home. And if that's not horrific enough, 45% of domestic violence perpetrators abuse not only their intimate partner, but turn and abuse their children as well. These are hard realities. And hardest of all, of course, for the victims. Survivors of DV are 3 times as likely to suffer PTSD, 2x as likely to develop symptoms of depression, 3x as likely to develop a major depressive disorder. Survivors are three times more likely to engage in self-harming behaviors, three times as likely to have suicidal thoughts, four times as likely to attempt suicide, and six times more likely to have substance abuse disorders. All of which suggests we vastly underestimate the reality and pervasiveness of domestic violence all around us. It is insidious. And regrettably, according to the research, the church is not immune to the plague. DV incidents among active churchgoers are nearly the same as those in the general populace. These are hard realities. And so we speak about it in the prayerful hope that we might do something about it. I think we can all agree that domestic violence of any sort is never, under any circumstance, an acceptable way to treat another human. DV is, to put it bluntly, sin, the opposite of flourishing communion. On that, I think we can all agree. But along with talking about it, and of course supporting the victims, what is it that we, as a church and individually, what is it that we can do to actually make a difference with regard to those disturbing statistics I've just shared with you? Well, to help provide at least one answer to that, I'd like to tell you about my grandmother, Nellie Bell Reed, and how she solved for me a question that had long troubled me about Jesus, and how that helped me see at least one way we can respond to domestic violence, both individually and as a community. So, let me begin with this. Do you happen to remember the days when you first encountered the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus' famous speech in Matthew 5 through 7? I myself was 16 years old when I first read it. And as a 16-year-old, there were two defining characteristics that I wore around along with every other person my age that I knew, like a pair of undergarments. Not always visible, but never without them. One, 16, meant raging hormones with no idea what to do about them. Two, perhaps because of that, 16 meant a moody and underlying anger about everything around me. And that was my Sittenleben, as the Germans say, my situation in life when I first encountered Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. And it is why, no doubt, that two lines in particular stood out to me in that sermon, like a pair of undergarments worn on the outside of one's clothing. You have heard it was said, Jesus tells them, you shall not murder. But I say to you, even if you get angry, you are liable to judgment. And you have heard it said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you, anyone who looks at another with lust has already committed adultery in their hearts. The two defining characteristics of my life at that moment as a 16-year-old when I first read those words, and Jesus is telling me they are tantamount to murder and adultery. And I gotta say, it was troubling to hear that. I mean, we all knew, my friends and I, we all knew that treating one another as objects of lust wasn't healthy for us, clearly. And we knew our implacable anger at just about everything our teacher said, everything our mom said, everything our friends said, wasn't good for us. Of course. But to link that with adultery and murder, well, it all seemed a bit too much to me. And honestly, I couldn't understand what Jesus was saying. But then, enter Nellie Bell, my grandmother. My grandma was one of those fortunate people who lived a remarkably healthy life, strong and vibrant into her mid-90s, save for one health issue that tormented her from age 18 on, diabetes. And for this reason, my grandmother spent her life on a mission to ensure that no one else in my family ever got it as well. Meaning, when Grandma Nellie came to visit, everyone in the house was going to have their glucose level checked by my grandmother regularly. She was going to poke your finger with a needle and test your blood. And though none of us were particularly fond of this, and despite the fact that this woman was 5 foot nothing, what she said, we did. And that was that. And so, one day, when I was 16, holding out my finger, angry, of course, asking why I had to do this yet again, my grandmother said something that had never quite registered with me before. She said, quite simply, well, we need to determine if you are pre-diabetic. I'd never heard that term before. And she told me it means you're not quite diabetic, but if you keep moving in the direction you're headed, you soon will be. And so she tested me so that if I was pre-diabetic, we could do something about it and perhaps avoid diabetes altogether. I still didn't like her needles, but her words were a revelation for me. And suddenly, I understood Matthew 5. Jesus was simply doing what my grandmother Nellie had been doing all along, helping us diagnose not adultery and murder, but what we might call pre-adultery or pre-murder, so that if we found we were moving in that direction, we could do something about it while there was still time and perhaps avoid the moral health issue he was reflecting on all together. Which is all to say, what Jesus and my grandma realized is that while adultery and murder and even diabetes are certainly serious issues, the real problem is the set of behavior patterns that lead to each of them in the first place. And that the only way to actually effectively deal with those big issues is to first and foremost deal with the pre-issues, the pre-behaviors that Jesus and Grandma were pointing to. Now, I say all of that because of this. When it comes to domestic violence and what we can do about it, I'd like to suggest the exact same principle applies. For domestic violence does not occur out of the blue, of course. It arises, like everything else in this world, from diabetes to adultery, with what we might call pre-DV, which, as it turns out, is precisely what Jesus is addressing in our lectionary passage from Mark chapter 10 today. You see, James and John have come to Jesus with one goal in mind. They want what they see all around them, in the lords and in the tyrants of this world, in the patriarchal household they've been a part of their whole life, and even what they see in the religious leaders of their day. They want, that is, seats at Jesus' right and left in glory, which is to say, they want power. and they want control. And that is precisely what I mean by pre-DV. For as you will recall from our earlier definition, at the heart of domestic violence, whether it comes in the form of intimidation, isolation, emotional abuse, blaming, coercion, threat, or stalking, all of these symptoms of domestic violence, the center of it all is the use of power to control another. The very thing, ironically, James and John were requesting, and the very thing, to our own complicity, we have continued to request again and again from that day until this one. As sad as the statistics about domestic violence make me, honestly, and I wonder if you can see this as well, they don't really surprise me. For in this world, as Jesus reminded his apostles, the use of power to control others is simply standard practice. In fact, we have built an entire society founded on such power and control. We not only practice it, we promote power and control. We celebrate it, we honor it, and sometimes we even vote for it. The use of power to be in control. Which makes what Jesus says next all the more important. Turning to his disciples. And here, Jesus is turning to all of us as well. He says to them, this may well be how it is in our world, with its lords and its tyrants. But I say, not so among you. This world will tell you that manliness is about power and control, but I say, not so among you. They will tell you the way to get your way in this world is to defeat others. But I say, not so among you. They will tell you violence and aggression is necessary. But I say, not so among you. They will tell you half-truths, oh, they're acceptable as long as we get our way. But I say, not so among you. They will tell you character doesn't matter so long as we get the results we want. But I say, not so among you. They will tell you humility is for the weak. But I say, not so. Not among you. They will tell you that the use of power to control others, which we practice in our private lives, our political lives, our religious lives, is the only way to keep this world safe and to keep that person in line. But I say to you, not so among you. Domestic violence is a plague on our world, but it does not come from nowhere. And just as the solution to murder is to begin with anger, the solution to adultery to begin with the lustful objectification of another, the solution to diabetes to begin with glucose checks. Just so with domestic violence. Let us certainly commit to doing everything we can to stopping actual domestic violence as it occurs. But let us also commit, perhaps even more importantly, to combat what Jesus might call pre-DV, such that wherever and whenever we see the use of power to control another in our private lives, in our political lives, and even in the practice of our faith lives, when we see that, let us commit to stand up, to stand together, and to say, not so among you. And thereby come to discover we're actually making a difference where it matters most. We do that, I can already see Jesus and Grandma Nellie high-fiving and chest-bumping in heaven. Amen.
Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, your perfect love is casting out fear.